Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Timothy Williams about his important new book, The Complexity of Evil, Perpetration and Genocide, published by Rutgers University Press in December of last year. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Of course. Thank you for being here. Can you start us off by telling our listeners a bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'd love to. I am a junior professor of insecurity and social order at the University of the Bundeswehr in Germany, where I have been based most of my life in Germany, even though, as you can probably tell by my accent, I was born in the UK. But I went through uni in both the UK and Germany and did my PhD and postdoc here in Germany. And I've been at this institution for about a year and a half now.
Thanks, Tim. And just to clarify, you said you mentioned insecurity in your title. Is that right? And I ask, you know, primarily because, you know, that seems like the reverse framing of most jobs that talk about security.
It is. It's an interesting framing, I guess. I think that it's quite. For me and my research, I think it's quite a useful and interesting framing because doing work on mass violence and on genocide and on participation in it, it's often the insecurity which is much more interesting to me than the conceptions of security. I'm a political scientist by training and sort of work in the field of genocide studies, international relations, conflict studies, but I think that the concept of security studies and the discussions here are obviously very relevant. But for me, in the sort of the titular nature of my professorship being insecurity, it resonates much more strongly with me. I didn't choose it, but I was happy to apply for it when I saw the job.
Thanks, Tim. You know, I like to ask my guests how they came to write their book. Why is perpetrator research important? How did you come to this research? And are there any scholars of that have influenced your research?
Yeah, I think that the main reason why I think that perpetrator research is so important is because we can really only understand violence and genocide and the dynamics that it takes on if we go into the micro level and look at the dynamics of individual perpetrators and to try and understand and to disaggregate the larger phenomenon of violence into its individual parts. And so part of that is obviously looking at these acts. And in previous research, there's obviously a lot of perceptions of victims which flow into genocide studies traditionally in the sort of founding years of genocide studies, and I think it's really good that this is sort of complemented by perpetrator studies, because while normatively obviously it's much more problematic what the perpetrators have done, to really understand the phenomenon, it's important, and this is then also important for any attempt, I would say, at prevention, we also need to understand how this works at a disaggregated level. And so with this interest in perpetrators, I realized that a lot of work was being done in various different disciplines, in various different cases, but often they weren't communicating with each other. So some of my, you were asking about influential scholars, Jim Waller's book, Becoming Evil, I thought was really inspiring. And looking at how perpetrators come to be perpetrators, how they decide to participate from a psychological perspective. But it sort of, it leaves out many of the other sorts of factors that could be relevant and that are talked about in other parts of the literature. And at the same time, people's amazing work like Leanne Fuji's Killing Neighbors or Strauss's Order of Genocide or McDoom's work is a really amazing studies about Rwanda, but they speak so wonderfully also to studies of the Holocaust, like Christopher Browning and others, but they don't necessarily communicate with each other. And so the idea was to try and bring these different literatures into conversation with each other and to try and see what can we learn from these different disciplines, from these different cases, and if we bring that together, so something more abstract, something which works in different cases. And then I obviously wanted to contribute empirically as well by looking at another case study, which is very different. And so I selected the case study of Cambodia. And that's really how the book sort of came to be, that I wanted to try and bring a lot of the things together that already existed and then try it out on a new case.
Great. Thanks, Tim. And I wanted to talk a bit about the packaging of your book. But before we do that, since you mentioned about bringing the literatures together and have them speak to each other, how is the complexity of evil model different from other tools of analysis that preceded it? And how does it build off of these approaches that existed prior to it? And also, what are the different levels of analysis that you bring into interaction? The different categories of motivations, the facilitative factors, and the contextual conditions. I know that was a lot of questions in one, but I'll turn it over to you.
It's different from previous literature because, similar to Waller, it tries to be holistic, bringing different kinds of factors together, and that it's agnostic to cases. But it goes beyond Waller's focus on psychology, and so I would say that's sort of the main thing that it differentiates from the literature. But what it really adds is that it looks for a more deeply embedded causal reasoning. And so this is how I came up with this differentiation between motivations, facilitative factors, and contextual conditions. Because I say that motivations are basically the actual impetus for people to participate in genocide. So it's the actual causal reason for someone to participate. Whereas other factors are only facilitative. That means that they only really come to work if there is a motivation already there. Now, this differentiation is not made at all in the literature otherwise, and I think that that's problematic because it means that some factors are sold as motivations, even though actually they're not the reason someone's participating, even though they're making it easier. And then we have contextual conditions, which again are not necessarily differentiated in the literature, and this is more of these are more factors that are they're contextual, they're societal often or situational, and they construct a framework within which people are acting, and it impacts how certain motivations can come to the fore in these certain situations. I can maybe exemplify this with the idea of ideology, because in the book I argue that ideology actually can be all three of these factors, but it has a different meaning in each of these. So ideology can be a motivation. So we do see that there are people in the Holocaust who are anti-Semitic and they're participating because of a hatred for the Jews and they want to eradicate Jews. Or in Cambodia, because they genuinely want to eradicate political enemies. But actually, and I'm not the first person to say this, but most people who participate are not ideologically motivated in that sense. That's not necessarily the reason. I identify many other reasons in my book, which I can maybe talk about a little bit in a second. But instead, ideology is very often a facilitative factor in the sense that it makes it easier. It provides a justification and a legitimation that psychologically either renders the victim more distant, dehumanizes them, or it makes the killing seem more legitimate. And as such, it's not enough for someone to kill someone just because they see it as legitimate, but it makes it makes other motivations much more easy to implement when it's there. And also, ideologies function as can function as contextual conditions, as the larger worldviews, the larger ideologies, which frame the entire situation, which render the context that people are acting in meaningful. And it says, who are we and who are they? The we versus us, we versus them differentiation. It creates threatening attributes for people who one can then victimize, and so on and so forth. And so by differentiating causally, I think that we can get a much more nuanced understanding of these factors. I said that I'd maybe say a little bit briefly about the different types of motivations that I identify. Basically, within the category of motivations, I think there are three main types of motivations that we have. The first one are in-group motivations, and this is one of the most important types of motivations because it's all about dynamics within the perpetrator group. It has absolutely nothing to do with the victims, but it has to do with hierarchical structures, authority. It has to do with peer pressures or wanting to be conform with the group, taking on specific roles within a situation, or wanting to gain status. And these are kinds of motivations that we can see in other parts of life as well. Obviously, group dynamics, a lot of these are social, psychological, and sociological, but they don't have anything to begin with, really, to do with the victim group. The second type of motivation are out-group focused motivations, so to do with the victim group. And these can be the ideological motivations I was speaking of, or emotional reactions to victims. So fear of the victim group, hatred towards them, or anger. And these out-group focused motivations are empirically the type of motivation that we find least often. And the third, which again, similar to in-group motivations, is empirically very broadly found, are what I call opportunistic motivations. So all kinds of motivations that mean that the perpetrator expects to gain some kind of benefit from their action, from their perpetration. And so this can be anything from economic motivations, where people hope to be able to loot and steal from the victim group. They can have career motivations that they hope to be to receive a promotion if they participate and kill. Personal conflicts that are where someone kills someone from the victim group because of some animosity that they have towards the person as that individual person, which has actually nothing to do with the genocide itself. And here we have a whole host of different motivations that where people believe that they can gain something from it. And so I try and differentiate here between a little bit more in a structured way, what are the fundamental mechanisms behind these motivations, and then differentiate those, as I said, from facilitative factors. Maybe one final word of how this differentiates from other types of approaches. it's probably become quite clear from the way I described the model that I see the fundamental basis for analysis as coming from the action that is perpetrated rather than from the role of perpetrator as such. This is because I see perpetrator more as a social construction, something that we attribute and to an individual because of the actions they've engaged in. And thus, I think that by focusing on individual actions, we can say for a specific point in time why an individual is engaging in a specific action, and their motivations can then change over time. It means that just because someone is motivated to kill for career motivations today, tomorrow it could be because of in-group pressures. And we can model this this dynamism much more strongly. And it also allows us to understand how people at some points will maybe perpetrate and at other points in time will maybe then rescue or be bystanders. And it allows this complexity to come out much more clearly.
Thanks, Tim. And you know, one of the things I'm thinking of from your book and your discussion of it is where does it sort of fit with, you know, those who believe in, I guess the very rigid understanding of specific genocidal intent. You know, when you're talking about all these different potential motivations, does this in any way differ from how genocide studies or I guess a good portion of genocide studies views genocidal intent?
I wouldn't say so. I think that intent is important, but it doesn't mean that in the individual action of perpetration, intent necessarily needs to be quite so clear. So what I mean by this is that people are participating in genocide as part of a larger movement. And similar to social movement studies, where people who go to protest, for instance, can be there for all sorts of reasons, but they're still part of the protest. They're still part of a movement. They're buying into something larger, even if that's not necessarily always part of it doesn't need to be an ideological belief that they have and that they are acting upon. And so the intent is much more a sort of a knowledge-based understanding of intent, and that people are participating as part of this group and part of a phenomenon. And for the genocide, for this action, which is then sort of aggregated to the genocide, the intent is necessary in that the victims need to be seen as a group that is supposed to be eliminated. And these ideologies are very important for justifying the action, even if I argue that this isn't necessarily the foundation for people's individual motivations for engaging in that action.
Right. And you know, a related question, you note in your book that you disregard theories of ancient ethnic hatred, instead seeing ethnicity as a potential sorting mechanism. Anything you want to just discuss about that? And have you encountered any resistance to this approach?
To be honest, not as much resistance as I would maybe have expected when I started writing the book. Because I think that within genocide studies, this idea of ancient ethnic hatreds is not really particularly accepted by most researchers. I think sort of the media tropes around the genocide in Rwanda and the genocide in Bosnia and the pushback against that in academia really helped a more nuanced understanding of how ethnicity isn't necessarily just this idea of an ancient ethnic hatred, which is automatically linked to identities. But at the same time, I think this connection between identity and ideology is still quite opaque and under-discussed in a lot of research. And to be perfectly honest, in the book, I don't spend too much time on discussing how ethnicity figures into these ideologies. But I do, like you said, see it more as a sorting mechanism. And this is how Lian Fuji describes it, in the sense that it helps people within their social situations to categorize people as us and them, to identify who the in-group is and the out-group is. And this can then also become part of a genocidal ideology when these become weighted as threatening or as dehumanized.
Thanks, Tim. And I want to, you know, have us take a step back now to, you know, the packaging of your book. And, you know, you discussed the cover image early on in your book. And so a couple of things, I guess. Can you tell our listeners about where the quote unquote, the complexity of evil comes from? Did you have any internal debate over whether to use the term evil? And also, can you describe for our listeners the cover image and how it relates to the content of your book?
Yeah, the title, The Complexity of Evil, is obviously a reference to Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil, because what Hannah Arendt amazingly did when she first published her ideas was to really break with this idea of perpetrators as psychopaths, as monsters, as ideological maniacs, and she did this in a really great way. And without wanting to claim that I'm going to have the same kind of impact that Hannah Arendt obviously had with her work, but I do think that the idea of trying to systematize this and to bring in what I call the complexity of evil, and to show that, yes, we can talk about individual motivations in individual cases, and we can talk about the banality of evil, but it's also really important to see that there isn't one answer to why people participate, that there are lots of different pathways, but that they are related to each other, that they do have, that we can think about these in a sort of a complex causal way. But at the same time, my concept of, well, I don't really have a concept of evil. I use it in the title as a label to tie in with Hannah Arendt, but I don't go into any of the philosophical conceptions of evil. Not only do I in the book not really engage with the term, I don't really use it very much at all, because it does have a lot of theological, philosophical contentions, which I don't necessarily think are particularly helpful for my social scientific approach. For the most part, because I am sort of pushing back against essentializing violence and the perpetrators behind it, and trying to think more in a much more concrete fashion about the types of action that people are engaging in. And so the label of evil that inherently has something to do with a normative ascription of what this violence means, I don't find to be particularly helpful. And you asked about the cover picture. It's on the first page of the book, I also discussed this, that I chose this because I curated an exhibition together with the photographer Daniel Welschenbach, in which we exhibited portraits of 11 former Khmer Rouge who had had some different roles within the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the late 1970s. And one of the exhibition openings that I was at, I heard someone talking about this photo, and they were talking about how you could see the evil in his eyes. And I stood there and I looked back at this portrait photo, which I'd seen many times before, and I couldn't see it. I couldn't think of this person as being inherently evil and being able to see it in him. And I even knew much better than the woman who had been saying this, the terrible things he'd done. But I think that this sort of essentialist understanding of him as evil led to so much internal pushback by me that I thought that I would like to have this picture on the book. obviously the picture is blurry, or not obviously, but I decided to have the picture blurry on the book to anonymize the person. Theoretically, I would have been allowed to use his picture clearly, but I didn't feel comfortable doing that. Yeah, because obviously it's a very prominent position to have one's photo. The Complexity of Evil being obviously a very strong title, and I didn't really want to associate a specific person with that connotation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned in the book that had the photo been in, say, maybe any other exhibit, would the person have seen evil in that photo? And just, you know, the way that it was contextualized maybe adds to that perception. And, you know, what you were just saying about how you could have used a photo that was not blurred, you know, in some ways that that connects to, you know, or I'd ask you if it connects to, you know, Shel Anderson and Aaron Jesse have an edited volume to which you contribute. And in it, at the end, they include a code of practice. And I was wondering whether your model and their code of practice might be seen as complementary in some ways.
The edited volume and the code of practice, I think, is a really it's a real testament to Aaron and Shel. It's really such an interesting read and very useful. And I do think that the code of practice is a really helpful foundation for thinking about how to do ethically sound perpetrator research. It's obviously a minefield, and it's and like the blurring of the picture, and how do we want to represent people? How do we want people to see individuals or not see individuals? I think this is really, really key. I wouldn't necessarily say that they speak to each other in any direct ways, but I would say that, because I think that what Aaron and Shel provide is a tool for thinking about how we can do research better, how we can design it, how we can conduct it, how we can write our research, represent the people we've been speaking to. Whereas the model is much more at a sort of an analytical level, how can we try and understand better the way that perpetrators act. But I very much hope that the research underlying my model it sort of ticks all the boxes of their code of practice. I'm sure I didn't. I mean, it was a long research project, and I definitely didn't do everything right. But it was important to me, and it continues to be important to me, to take ethical considerations into account. I have at conferences from time to time had people sort of have a much more blasé approach to this, mostly people who don't necessarily work on perpetrators, interesting, and that the sense that because of the actions that they've engaged in, they lose their right to be treated in particularly ethical ways as respondents. And I couldn't disagree less with that. I think that because we have the privilege as researchers of hearing their stories, and their stories are obviously include many really terrible things that they've engaged in, but this doesn't absolve me of treating them as humans and not dehumanizing them as they have their victims. And I think that Aaron and Shel really do an amazing job in that concluding chapter in bringing together these ideas and posing the right questions that we should be asking.
Well, what you just said relates to another question I wanted to ask you, which was, you know, has the taboo associated with researching and therefore what might be seen as wrongfully humanizing, although I don't agree with that, humanizing perpetrators, has that taboo diminished at all?
I think to a certain degree, it has. I think since the 1990s with the Goldhagen and Browning debate, and a lot of the pushback that got in terms of how can we talk about perpetrators, how can we do this research, and all the great work that then in the early 2000s was done in Rwanda. I think that a lot of the taboo has gone away. But at the same time, I, if I give public lectures, I very strongly still feel that it's seen as a taboo to humanize perpetrators, and it comes from an understandable position that I think many people, without reflecting on it, want to see themselves as different to perpetrators and want to believe that they're a different category of people, and that they wouldn't have acted in these ways because they're a different kind of person. And I obviously hope that every person who thinks this wouldn't, being put in the same situations, act in that way. But I am very skeptical of that. I think that most people would. And so I think the taboo serves a social function or a psychological function for many people. But within academia, as I said, I think that this idea of humanizing perpetrators is becoming much more strongly anchored, and for good reason.
Thanks, Tim. And, you know, moving into your book a little, but also, you know, just thinking about how, you know, you said not everyone finds themselves in the position where they are, you know, making decisions about whether to participate in violence or not, you know, which comes back to, again, your model and the motivations, facilitative factors, and contextual conditions. And so going into the structure of your book, which I found extremely effective, you include these the interspersal of vignettes among the analysis. Where did the idea for the structure of your book come from? And can you talk about these stories and how they relate to your model?
Yeah, I was so excited when my publisher said that they liked the idea of the vignettes, because, like I said, the people who I spoke to are people who gave me the privilege of hearing their story. And with the vignettes, I feel that I'm able to give a little bit of a better idea of the people who are behind the model, particularly because the way the rest of the book is structured, it has a lot of quite it tries to systematize things, it tries to show causal ordering and abstract mechanisms, and so by being able to and I include a lot of examples throughout the book, but but they're always ripped apart, as it were, and decontextualized because it's about the specific different motivations. And with the vignettes, I hope to be able to tell in a more contextualized way the stories of individual people. And obviously, unfortunately, the vignettes are only ever a couple of pages long. The interviews that went on for several hours, often over multiple sittings. Obviously, the transcripts are much, much longer, but these are the very condensed versions of that. And I'd seen or I'd read about vignettes as a method of thinking about data, and I'd read novels in which you sort of have this vignette-y approach, but I'd never seen it actually done in academia in this way. And so, I thought, why not? It sort of represents these people and allows us to engage with their stories better. And so I think it sort of allows this the abstract model to come to life a little bit better. I can maybe sort of for one of these vignettes sort of show how it illustrates the model. So one of my interviewees, who was a militiaman from Battambang province, I call him Chandara in the book. It's a pseudonym, obviously, to make sure that no one recognizes him. He has a fascinating story, which on the individual level is completely unique and interesting. But also, a lot of the things he talks about speak to broader mechanisms. So, for instance, I speak about him also in the part of the book where I talk about taking on a role and how in-group dynamics within the perpetrator group construct a way that you think about what it means to be a perpetrator. And so he has this really evocative quote where he talks about when he joined the Kamurocho, he knew that he was entering a tiger zone. So he had to become a tiger and had to become cruel like a tiger. And so sort of talking to how it meant he knew that he had to take on an alternative morality, an alternative and engage in alternative practices. At the same time, he also talks a lot about how he came to the Khmer Rouge as a strategy for ensuring his own security, that he'd and then even with as a militiaman, he felt the effects of a very coercive totalitarian system in pushing him to have to act in the way that his superiors thought this. But he also speaks about other people within his group and talks about how he sees other people who are the most active and willing killers being the ones who are most quickly promoted and speaks this to this as a motivation for some of his peers to have participated. And I think one of the things why I was fascinated about talking to him when I was doing my field research was because he also talked about a lot of the everyday group dynamics and how he, in many situations, managed to avoid killing and how the way that the group was structured and the way that the group dynamics played out on a day-to-day basis, it meant that certain people would be much more involved in killing than others, even if towards the outside, it looked as if the group was acting. And so those are the kind of some of the things that you can pull out of the vignettes. There are also a few others as well, but they speak to different parts of the books and sort of the book and bring them together in the story of one person.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, and like I said, I think it's a very effective way to, you know, as you mentioned, balance the sort of the data with these stories. And so the example you just provided was from Cambodia. And as you mentioned before, in addition to Cambodia, you also do research on Rwanda and the Holocaust. And can you talk about why you chose these cases and whether you considered any others? And also what were some of the differences you found? And in terms of Rwanda, what similarities did you find?
So I, of the three cases, Rwanda and the Holocaust were from the beginning clear that I would include them. And this was because these are the two cases which in the perpetrator literature so far, there's been most work done on them. There have been excellent studies by the people I was mentioning earlier who inspire me, Leanne Fuji, Scott Strauss, Omar McDoom, Christopher Browning, and many others on these two cases, which I knew I would be able to extract a lot of the mechanisms and the ideas from. And then the idea was to try and take the empirical insights from these two relatively well-researched cases and the further ideas from various different disciplines and then try to map it onto and see whether it works, a model that I created, in a very different kind of case. And actually, Cambodia wasn't the first case that I considered working on. I'd imagined working on Armenia, although I'd assumed how much documentation I would be able to find in the form of original ego documents by perpetrators. There are a lot of victim accounts, but very few openly available. I think there are closed archives, possibly in Turkey, which are not accessible, where one could find that. I also considered working on Bosnia. This would have been preferable in terms of timing, given that it's a more recent case than Cambodia. But given the political situation in the country and the very strong degree of politicization of the violence still today, it didn't sort of my first forays into thinking about doing the kind of research where I'd be doing field work, looking for perpetrators and speaking to them. It didn't really feel feasible. And then I came to Cambodia, and it works out as a very good case, because the way that the memoryscape is structured today in Cambodia, many of the people who I was speaking to were happy to speak to me about their experiences, because they, while they recognized that they engaged in these acts of killing and of torture and all the other things that they did, they also see themselves as victims of a totalitarian regime. And in that sense, they also wanted to tell their stories from both these perspectives, and that made it easier to engage with them. And so I then went to Cambodia, did a scoping trip, and realized that this would work out, and then did some a longer field trip of 6 months where I spent time in 10 different provinces. And then once I'd analyzed all the data, I realized that the model performs well in explaining why people participate in Cambodia, albeit with differences to other cases. I think the main difference to other cases is the role that the social dynamics took on. So while in the Holocaust and in Rwanda, the in-group peer pressure and dynamics where people wanted to be conform with their friendship groups or with their comrades was much less strong in Cambodia, because people, after they were recruited, were very often split up from friends who they were recruited with and sent to other parts of the country at the latest after training. And so from that point of view, people were thrown into situations with people who they didn't know. And at the same time, given that the Khmer Rouge regime became increasingly worried or even paranoid about internal enemies within the organization, and were increasingly purging and killing Khmer Rouge cadres, there was a strong degree of insecurity experienced, and so people didn't engage in friendly relations to the same degree as we know from other cases of genocide. But because of denunciations and because of this fear of how one's perceived by one's superiors and comrades, people very much more strongly kept to themselves. So that's one of the key differences. But at the same time, I found that the model was quite helpful for me to look at this and to see this as something which wasn't so present, or how it then the group dynamics worked much more strongly, or the social isolation in this case worked more strongly as a facilitative factor rather than as a motivation, as it had in other cases. And obviously, the dynamics are quite different. What perpetration meant was different in Cambodia to in other cases. The way that the enemy was constructed as threatening, who was seen as the enemy, the types of ideology that were purported were different. But the fundamental mechanisms underlying them and how they impacted people's perceptions and their propensity to engage in violence remained the same. And interestingly, despite the very different situation in which people were overworked, starving, were losing family members themselves, a lot of the opportunistic factors were actually quite also followed similar mechanisms, albeit much more oriented towards more basic survival than actually progress, be it economically or career-wise.
Thanks, Tim. And you know, that ultimately connects to something in your concluding remarks I wanted to talk about, which is how you talk about your findings from the application of your model to these cases, showing the potential of your model for analysis of other cases. Do you have plans for this? I mean, one thing that comes to mind, and maybe it's because of that that documentary on Indonesia. But I would be very interested to see your model applied to the genocide or politicide in the mid 60s. Yeah, so do you have plans to do more cases? Do you hope other scholars will adopt or adapt your complexity of evil model for further study? And I know your book hasn't been published for too long now, but have you been able to share your model with others and given any response to it?
I would love to use the model and adapt or implement it for other cases. It's interesting you refer to the documentary on the Indonesian genocide. You might be referring to Joshua Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing, which I actually watched with my class yesterday in class, and as an introduction to the way the politics of memory is structured in Indonesia. And I think it would be absolutely fascinating to go to Indonesia and spend time with perpetrators and talk to them, because from my understanding, and I'm not a scholar of the Indonesian genocide at all, but I do think that that a lot of the mechanisms that I identify in the book could be useful for understanding perpetration there. I don't actually have plans to do this myself at the moment, mostly because it was a labor of love, but it did. I mean, the book and all the research behind it was obviously a long project, and I've for myself decided I need to work on something new as well. I'm looking more now at sort of post-conflict societies and how perpetration is constructed there. That's going to be my next project. But at the same time, I hope that I'll be able to return to the model as part of a case study of in other places as well, because I believe that with the model, it can be used as a heuristic, as a tool for myself, but also for others, as part of larger analyses of microdynamics. So it can just be one sort of part of an analysis that people use and people apply when they're looking at the micro level, when they're looking at perpetrators, to be able to relatively easily and systematically try and locate how people are coming to participate, why they're doing this. I think one of the big gaps in the literature at the perpetrator level is on how motivations change over time. And this is something that I don't address in the book, but I would love to be able to return to this at a later date, and in maybe a new case study, look at how over time, from one act of violence to another, motivations can shift. How some become more salient, others become less salient. And I have an article with Jan Reinemann with a few sort of initial thoughts on this, but we'd need to do a lot more empirical research. And I believe that the way I'm understanding discussions within perpetrator studies, that other people find this idea of dynamism also quite interesting. So I hope that the model will be able to be useful to people from that perspective, and to be able to very systematically approach looking at these changes. Also because as I very briefly mentioned earlier, I think that this is key for any attempt at prevention, useful ways of thinking about how we can use the insights we have on perpetrators to actually prevent other people from becoming perpetrators. The response to the book so far has been positive, I think. People seem to think that it's useful for approaching the topic, and that it can be used as a sort of as a framework to look at perpetrators as an overlay for understanding the mechanisms which underlie how this connection between motivation and action.
I'm glad it's receiving a positive response so far. I'd like to include myself in that. One thing I was thinking about, something I've thought about before, which, you know, I guess could be a project down the road, is just sort of comparing the sort of the motivations for perpetration and the evolution of them, possibly depending on, you know, the case and the individual, but also then, you know, comparing that with the motives behind those who are planning, who are, you know, directly involved in the planning or inciting of the political violence or the genocidal violence, because it just seems to me that those who are planning and inciting may have very different motivations or objectives than the people that they are encouraging in some ways to perpetrate the violence directly against, you know, the targeted group. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but yeah.
I couldn't agree more that I think that this is really important. I think where sort of perpetrator studies, right at the beginning of genocide studies, was very focused on the highest leaders and on individual biographies of these people. And then there was a really strong push towards then in the 90s and the early 2000s towards looking at the individual perpetrators who are implementing it, the low-level cadres. I feel that we do need to bring the leaders back in as people who are acting within a context, but also a key to shaping this context. And I think that we will find some parallel motivations. I do think that social dynamics will play a surprising role in why people act in the way they do, minimally in how they perceive their situations, and that opportunistic motivations are obviously are discussed in the literature. But I do think that ideologies are more important at these higher levels than they are lower down the chain of command, as it were. But I think it is an open question to what degree that is the case. And I think it would be a useful endeavor to take the model, take the book, and see whether it also works for those in power. It's as an open question, and what we can then learn from that for prevention, but also for just for analysis of the violence dynamics, I think could be quite insightful.
Agreed. Well, Tim, as we come near our close here, you know, towards the end of your book, you talk about the potential application of your model to other forms of violence, and you note that right now, you know, it would be, you know, purely speculative to come to any conclusions on its applicability. But if you were to start with genocide and expand on the use of your model from there, say outward from genocide, is there a form or type of violence that you think makes the most sense to apply the model to next outside of, say, genocide studies?
I think so. I've thought about this quite a lot over the last couple of years in terms of, well, what else can we do with this model? And particularly because the literatures are very structured according to the types of violence. And we have sort of terrorism studies, we have genocide studies, we have civil war studies. And that I do genuinely think there needs to be more conversations happening between these disciplines. But they are distinct, these types of violence. But I think that what the model would be most useful in thinking about would be group-based forms of violence, because I think that this is so key to genocide, that they are implemented to the perpetration of genocide, that they're implemented always as parts of groups with differing amounts of organizational structure, and that they're embedded within some kind of ideological framework. And so I think for this, possibly riots or pogroms and riots could be a useful universe of cases to look at next. And I actually have just started a new research project on riots. It's looking at it from a different perspective and a much more sort of, I'm no longer looking at the late 1970s in Cambodia, but on Twitter and Twitter data and looking at riots. And I hoped as part of this project also be able to see whether we can understand a little bit more about why people participate in riots and pogroms as violent action, and see whether the model would also be applicable there. Obviously, the kinds of data that I have doing Twitter analysis is not necessarily going to allow me to do the same kinds of analyses that sitting down with someone for multiple sessions of several hours gives the kind of data. But I think that creatively, hopefully, over the next couple of years with my team, we'll be able to as one part of the project, look at that. Yeah, but I also think that it could be useful to look at motivations in civil wars, in terrorism. It's purely speculative, but there are lots of parallels between, at the individual level, how people perceive their situations, how people perceive the other who they're killing. And I don't see why it wouldn't be useful to use the model and look at that. And then, if at all, then to see what the differences are between the forms of violence.
Sure, I agree with that. I mean, I think there's also the element you mentioned, the other of at least for framing for participation purposes, there oftentimes can be a sort of in-group and an out-group in terms of the the violence. You kind of got ahead of me on my. I like to usually ask in my closing. What my interviewee is working on currently. You mentioned a couple of different research directions you're going in post-conflict society with the riots. Are these articles, are these books, are these things that our listeners can keep their eye out for?
So I'm working on two fields. One is the politics of memory in post-conflict or post-genocide societies. And I'm working on a book myself and a co-authored book with four colleagues. Five of us are trying to write a book together in which we look at... It's going remarkably well. they're four absolutely wonderful colleagues. So it means it's actually quite fun writing together, where we look at cultural heritage and how the politics of memory contributes to peace in post-conflict societies. The other larger project that is literally just starting at the moment is looking at digital dynamics of violence. And here I'm straying further afield from genocide, and it's focusing on riots. I think that this makes it interesting to try and see how different forms of violence at the individual level are perceived, what it means for motivations, what it means for discourses that emerge. So I'm excited to see what kinds of parallels we can find in that project.
Great. Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time. I do look forward to reading your forthcoming work. And when these books come out, if I'm still doing this, perhaps we can do this again.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. It was